Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hello and welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. My name is Peter Matthews and I'm an editor here at Firehouse. And I would like to welcome you to a new podcast series called Training and Tactics Talk. Today we have five fire officers from across the U.S. who are here to talk about different tactics, different scenarios, and how they would play them out where they come from, and also based upon their experience in the fire service. We have Tom Graber, Ed Hadfield, Larry Manasco, Russ Merrick, and Jeff Pendelski. Tom, would you just give us a little bit of a background about your fire service history?
Sure. I've been on the FDNY for 21 years. The last five have been as a battalion chief. I also serve in, I'm able to work in the safety battalion and the special operations command as a fill-in chief when they need a backup there.
Okay. Ed.
Yeah, hey, Pete. It's Ed Hadfield here, and I have over 20 years of fire service experience out here in the Southern California region, operating in the major metropolitan areas of Orange County and that. Recently took a promotional opportunity. I'm currently the operations chief for the Paso Robles Fire Department, and a lot of specialty in training and strategy and tactics, truck company operations, and firefighter safety and survivability.
Okay, then you have Firetown training specialists too, correct?
That's correct, yeah. We have an instructional cadre that travel throughout the United States. The name of the organization is Firetown Training Specialist, and we provide hands-on fire service training to organizations in the fields of truck company operations, as I said, firefighter safety, survivability, and recently, because of the influx of the newer generation of firefighters, we've been doing a lot of successional development planning for officers and that, hence the last webcast that we did, the Captain's College.
Okay, great. And that's firetowntrainingspecialist.com, is that also correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's our website.
Okay, great. Next up is Larry Manasco.
Yeah, Lieutenant Larry Manasco. I've been lieutenant going on 4 years now. I've been with Fort Worth for 12. Much it. I'm the low man totem pole on this one.
Larry's also one of our contributing editors who writes the monthly column, Company Level Training, so please look out for that. Next up is Russell Merrick.
Hi, Pete. Russ Merrick. I'm with the City of Rochester Fire Department in Rochester, New York. Currently a captain there. 20 years with the fire department, and I have 12 years on the volunteer side also. Currently, I'm a covering officer. I fill in for the company officers when they're on furlough. So.
Okay. And last but not least, this is going by alphabetical order, so no offense to anybody here, but next up is Jeff Pendelski.
Hi, everyone. Jeff Pendelski. I'm a battalion chief with the Downers Grove Fire Department over in Illinois. I've been with the department for 14 of my 17 years in the fire service. Prior to becoming battalion chief, I served on the truck and heavy rescue company in our department for 12 years as both a firefighter and company officer. I've had the opportunity to work in the fire service both on a career department as well as volunteer and part-time basis.
All right, great. And then you have the textbook out from Del Mar that's RICO, Rapid Intervention Company Operations. You want to just give us a quick bit of information about the book?
That's correct, Pete. The book's published through Del Mar Publishing. I am the co-author along with Lieutenant Mike Mason. It's basically a 400-page manual covering everything from fire ground self-survival to the operations of rapid intervention company teams.
All right, great. Well, we'll start off. For those of you listening, if you have any questions you'd like us to pose to the groups in the future shows, please use the following email address. It's podcasts@firehouse.com. That's PODCASTS@firehouse.com. The first question I'll throw out actually is going to go to Russ, and it's about the Quint MIDI concept that you guys use in Rochester. If you could just tell us a little bit about that, I think it's pretty unique. I did an internship there when I was in high school, and with the exception of Syracuse, New York, and Rochester, New York, it's the only place I've heard such a system used. So, Russ, can you give us a little background about that?
Sure. Back in the late or mid to late 80s and early 90s, like every major fire department in the Northeast, we were looking at budget constraints. So they've got a committee together that looked at how they could make some adjustments within the department but still not really affect the operations of the department. And what they basically did was look at the double houses where an engine and a truck company were stationed, and they decided that they could do a manpower reduction of four officers and eight firefighters at every station if they put a Quint MIDI concept together. And basically what they did is they eliminated the truck company and put a Quint in its place. We're running 110-foot E1 aerials right now. And instead of the full-size engine, they put a MIDI in there with two firefighters assigned to the MIDI, and they run as a single unit, a Quint and a MIDI. So every double house basically went from a truck and an engine to a Quint MIDI. The Quint will carry an officer and three firefighters, and the MIDI has two firefighters on it. So they run in pretty much together on every calls except for EMS. The MIDI will run EMS solely on its own, and its primary mission at fires is to supply the Quint with water.
Okay, great. Yeah, it's something I find interesting when I had moved up there, and something I'd like to throw out to everybody. So let's go with the first question. It's a general question, not an incident type of question, but since everybody here is a company officer, what is your biggest concern when you arrive at the scene of a working fire, whether it be a house fire or a structure fire, a private dwelling fire? What's the first thing that pops into your mind, whether it be safety, the firefighters on board, the situation at hand? I know it's going to be a little bit different, but what's something that kind of reoccurs to you each time around? Ed, we'll start with you on this one.
Great. I think throughout the fire service, we're all recognizing that we've had a dramatic shift into a younger fire service, and that of a lot of our officers are less experienced. So as a chief officer arriving on scene and taking the position of the seat of command, my concern is the situational awareness of what my officers saw upon arrival, trying to determine as to their descriptive size up or 952, what they saw and what actions they took. As everybody knows, in the region of the West, we deal with a lot of lightweight engineered structures, and many of those are susceptible to early collapse when they've had direct flame impingement upon the structural members of that, whether it be truss roof construction, quiet floors, or wooden I-beam truss floors. We're seeing a great deal of early failures in our structures throughout here. So my concern is my officer's observations, what situational awareness he saw, and did he take the appropriate actions. One of the first things that I do when I arrive on scene and take the position at the seat of command is I go through my accountability of my companies, and we follow an acronym called PPPN, or Personnel, Position, Progress, and Needs. So once the face-to-face is done with the initial arriving officers and determined what his operational strategy and tactics are, we capture our PPPN, which is personnel, where they located, what units are operating, their position within the fire ground or in or around the fire ground, their progress on the fire or on their tactical objectives, and what needs I can feed to them. So once we've been able to do that, then we're able to kind of take the ball and run with it. couple of the things that we recognize that our officers are missing, and in fact I did a research project on this for the National Fire Academy, was that approximately 62% of company officers on the West Coast fail to recognize hostile event recognition. So upon arrival, they're not reading the building based upon building occupancy and type, nor are they reading the building properly based upon fire involvement and hostile event recognition, which is your rollovers, flashovers, backdraft smoke, explosions, and so forth. And then tactically approaching the occupancy to mitigate those potentials of the hostile event or of the potential of structural collapse. I think that that's kind of a failure on the fire services side, because we haven't really addressed through adequate development of our officers this situational awareness, or what we refer to often as RPDM, which is a recognition prime decision model. Their slide carousel is basically empty. And that being said, unless we're doing more and more runs, giving them the hands-on experience, or unless we're doing realistic-based fire training for them, we're failing to adequately provide them with the tools necessary to do their job. And again, recognizing that, it's really my job to front load these people and then on the scene of emergency really capture what they saw, what decisions they made, and to feed the resources to accomplish the task.
All right, great. Next up is Larry. What is your biggest concern upon arrival at the scene of a working fire for you? What's your biggest concern?
Well, this will pretty much go hand in hand with what Ed said. My two concerns, I've been on an engine company my entire career, and so my two concerns are always how the building's going to react to the fire and simply finding the seat of the fire. Every structure's different. You can have two houses that are built exactly the same. Furniture's always set up different. Some are cluttered, some are not. And just trying to make your way to the seat of the fire, because generally you get to the seat of the fire, a lot of your problems are solved. So those are always my two concerns.
Okay. Next up would be Jeff Pendelski. Jeff, what are your biggest concerns upon arrival at the scene of a fire?
Well, Pete, I'm not going to buck the system too much with other guys already mentioned. I'm pretty much in line with them. On a strategic level, as an incident commander, of course, my number one priority is always going to be the safety and accountability of my people. Bringing this further down, though, to the tactical level involves executing a thorough size-up. As already was mentioned, again, this is so important because this serves as the foundation for everything else that we do on the fire ground. The importance of getting a look at as much of that building as possible prior to committing those resources cannot be overemphasized. What features are present that are unique to that building or its construction that could cause harm to our people, impede their search, or even their escape if an emergency comes up? Things such as, is the building a two-story from the front, a three-story from the rear when you walk around to the back? Does a parapet wall in front hide that deadly bowstring truss that we can't see unless we get to the sides or back of the building? Getting to the other sides of the building just helps us eliminate the need of possibly putting members in precarious situations that may cause them to need to employ aggressive search tactics. I mean, is it possible that occupants got out through an alternate exit? With others out front stating that they are missing and not out front, quickly popping that door along the side or the rear can possibly leave you with a victim right by the door. It could even give us a better entry point for the engine company to make their lead out. Fire conditions, reading smoke, they're also so integral to that size up also. I know there was the one acronym that Fred had mentioned already. It was great. Another one that we utilize for this is BAG, B-A-G. It's a great system used for evaluating fire conditions. Actually, this was passed down to me from a retired chief from Chicago by the name of Ed Enright a few years ago. BAG simply stands for where has the fire been, where is it at, and where is it going? We also have to ask the question, can we meet the critical fire flow needed to make an interior attack on that fire in that building? If we can't do that, I feel that we can't commit personnel to those interior positions. I mean, we could talk for hours and hours about just size up alone. But these are the points that just jump out at me that I feel are most important. And again, I feel this way because it does lay the foundation for everything else that takes place on that fire ground.
Okay. Tom Graber, you're up next.
All right. Well, obviously, and we touched on this already, the biggest concern when we get to a working fire, and especially with the diversity that I have working in the Bronx, is what do we have? And now I know we touched on it, and everything is obviously life safety and the safety of both the firefighters and the civilians inside, but it's just what Jeff was talking about. What do we have? It's the size up. You know, as you move up the ladder in the ranks, your perspective kind of changes. When you're a firefighter, possibly the engine chauffeur, your priority and your main concern is water supply. Where's my hydrant, or how am I going to supply water to this? You know, you move up, you're a company officer, you start thinking kind of like what Larry said about he wants to find the seat of the fire and how is he going to attack it. When you start getting up to the command and the chief level when you're outside, you're putting all these pieces together. Do we have a water supply? But we're taking all this size up and getting the whole big picture. You know, not just is the fire on this floor and how am I going to get to it, but do we have the water supply, the structural stability? Do I have enough resources? That's a big thing for the incident commander outside getting the big picture. A lot of times the first two units that are going in and attacking the fire directly are just seeing their piece of the fire. They're not getting the big picture from the other reports, possibly from somebody outside, somebody on the roof, structure of the building, how it's built. I believe Ed was talking about the bowstring and the parapet wall concepts like that, these other type of dangers that might not have been known to the line officers and the first two companies that are going in there. But as an incident commander, we have to take this size up and process all this information in order to how are we going to achieve that main concern of keeping the firefighters safe and also getting the civilians out. If we take all this stuff together, we have to do we have enough resources to continue to put this fire out? Do we need to call more? Is it going to be an interior operation or an outside operation? And it's the continual process of the size up. It's not just the initial size up when you get there, because the size up continues to change. And we have to keep processing that until finally all the hose is packed up and everything's done and put away, that we know, okay, we're successful in our job of keeping everybody safe and extinguishing this fire in the safest and quickest possible way.
Okay, Russ, we'll finish up with you. Russ Merrick, do you have anything else to add?
As everyone else has already mentioned, obviously safety is my number one concern anytime I pull up onto a scene. We want to throw acronyms out there. Another one that I use regularly is SCORE, S-C-O-R-E. When I pull up a scene size up, and I'm looking at the type of structure and involvement, where the fire is located. Also, in that size up, I want to try and at least get a 360 if I can. So, well, the crews are preparing to enter or ladder the building, whichever company I'm riding on that day. I'll try and do a quick 360 of the building. Actually, you know, you don't even have to go all the way around. We try to capture three sides coming in. So all I have to do is run down between the houses and take a quick look at the back, because that, obviously, if we have a life safety issue in the back of the structure, our tactics are going to change very quickly. So scene size up is for the S and SCORE. The C stands for command. I take command, and we can have three modes of command there. We can go into an investigative mode if there's not enough information that we're seeing readily upon pulling up to give a good thorough size up. We'd go into an investigative mode where we'd be looking for further information to update the units that we're responding in and give them further information and instructions. If we have a fire in one room in content or an incipient stage, we'd go into a fire tack mode and still maintain command. Unfortunately, in our department, we are not fortunate to have officers that can just supervise and direct the crews. We have working officers where we have to actually take hand tools in and help stretch lines or force entry or pull ceilings. We just don't have the luxury of a lot of firefighters to do that anymore, especially when we went to the Quinton MIDI concept. And lastly, depending if it is of any magnitude, then obviously we're going to take command right away. The third part of that would be our O or our objectives or setting up our organization and to see what type of strategies we're going to put into play there. The fourth one there was our resources, R for resources. Do we have a sufficient amount of resources either on location or are they en route? If not, obviously we need to call for more resources. And then the E there would be to evaluate, constantly going back and seeing, are our resources sufficient to meet our objectives, and are we meeting our objectives? And if we're not meeting our objectives, why aren't we meeting those objectives? And then if it's a lack of resources, getting the additional resources to meet the objectives. Obviously, if we're reaching our objectives successfully, then we can start looking at maybe de-escalating here and sending some more resources back in service. The other thing, well, I'm talking about Quinton MIDI's. One of the things that we have difficulty with, and I talk about safety from the get-go there, is we do split our crews up on the Quinton MIDI. We'll send two gentlemen or firefighters, if you will, to the roof for ventilation. And then the other crews will do, if we're first on scene, obviously we're going to be stretching lines. If we're coming in second too, we'll be doing the truck work. But initially, we're going to be having two firefighters for ventilation, and the rest of us will be doing inside attack. So my concerns are for the crew that I'm splitting up and their whereabouts and their safety. Obviously, I'm not able to be there watching them. Hopefully, after they finish their mission, then they would report to command and be reassigned. And hopefully, depending on the nature of the incident, they would hopefully be reassigned back to where I would be located with the rest of the crew, but that's not always the case. So that's one of my biggest concerns is the safety of our firefighters.
All right, great. Thank you, guys. We're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back in a minute here on radio at firehouse.com.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hello and welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk on Radio at Firehouse. Again, if you have any questions you'd like for the panelists to answer down the road, please send us an email to podcasts@firehouse.com. That's P-O-D-C-A-S-T-S @firehouse.com. The next question is going to be a question based upon an incident. It's a fictional incident that just kind of gives you the idea to think about all the different things coming together, because this is not on a PowerPoint. You can't really visualize it, but I'll give you the best word description I can give you. Incident one is it's just after 10:30 p.m. and you're covering for another station that is at a nearby working fire, and you were assigned to a report of smoke in the area from a cell phone caller. Due to the nature of the call, you and your crew, which is a driver and two firefighters, are the only engine company assigned. You arrive to find heavy smoke showing from the first and second floors of sides A and B, or 1 and 2, of a very large 2.5-story dwelling, we'll say a 2,500-square-foot house. There's one car in the driveway, but none of the neighbors are present and nobody's outside the home. You radio the dispatcher of a working fire and are advised that the next unit in is an engine company, but it's about 7 minutes out due to the fire going on. As the officer, you run up and take a quick look inside the car, and you see two child seats. What are your priorities for everybody here today? And I guess in what order would you carry out what tasks in the next 7 minutes until you get another company there to help you out? Again, it's a 2,500 square foot house, so and you've got smoke showing from two floors on sides A and B. We'll start off on this one with Russ Merrick.
Okay, Pete. First, pulling up when I'm seeing brown, heavy brown smoke. My first thought is I've got some kind of structure involvement already. It's beyond the incipient stages there. one thing I'm going to do is if I saw the car seats in the car, I'd want to look and see if there was tags or plates on the car, see if it was registered for the road. And I'd also be checking to see if there are any lights on in the house. At 10:30 at night, it's still possible that people are up. I mean, in our city, they leave the lights on in some of the houses most of the night. So I'd be looking for signs of anyone being at home. It's hard to say exactly what the next process is going to be. Obviously, we're strapped with firefighters there. We haven't got a whole lot to work with, so we're going to start stretching a line and hopefully try and make some type of progress to see. We're going to locate, as a matter of fact, if you go back to score there, we're going to try and locate where that fire was and try and get some lines on the fire. As far as making any type of aggressive interior attack, we really can't be doing anything of that nature without another crew there, obviously, to meet the letter of the law for our two in, two out. However, if I know that I've got occupants that are trapped inside there, then we can wave off that two in, two out. But again, I have to know that for sure. And just from the signs of car seats in the car and a car in a driveway, I've been at fires before where there's five cars in the driveway, but there's nobody home. It's a tough call. I'm not really sure how aggressive we're going to get.
Okay. Tom Graber, you're next up on this smoke showing from the two floors of a home at 10:30 p.m.
All right. Well, first, this would be kind of a not realistic scenario for where I'm working, but this would definitely fit in exactly to a scenario that would happen where I live, out in the suburbs, where there is volunteer companies. And the manpower would be or could be very similar to what you had, where it's a sizable time frame before you're getting more help there, limited manpower on the scene. As a company officer on a rig, as you described, with a driver, an officer, as me as the officer, and two firefighters with the scene, I know we have a perceived life hazard here with a private dwelling. Russ was just mentioning, it's not guaranteed, but it is perceived. I would ensure, or I would get that first line into the building to protect the open, unenclosed interior stairs. In a private dwelling, the greatest hazard, both to the occupants and the firefighters doing the search, would be to protect that open interior stairway that's inside the building. I would think with a driver, two firefighters stretching the line, the driver connecting to a water supply, hopefully it would be a hydrant system, and myself probably acting as an officer and also a forcible entry firefighter grabbing tools to force entry, we try to get that line to protect that interior stairs. If when we force entry and gain entry to the first floor, we could possibly find and contain that fire, that would be outstanding before we would make a choice of going up to the upper floors where we'd perceive most of the sleeping quarters would be. Again, what I mentioned about the size up constantly changing, that would play into effect this scenario also. If we force the door, and like I said, we could find, possibly contain the fire, maybe protect those stairs and possibly make a chance to go up and do a search on the upper floors looking for a life hazard, we'd have to make that decision once we get into that building. But my main emphasis would be to try to get a charge line in there to protect that stairway.
Okay. Next up would be Larry Manesco.
Okay. Well, me and my crew have actually spoke about if something like this were to happen. Where my station is positioned, we're on the corner of our city. We're still very busy. But if we go south, then nobody's coming our direction. Usually when they're coming from all different directions. Well, everybody, when we're going south, we're going away from everybody. So we could get something where there's going to be a few minutes, not 7 minutes, but still a few minutes. What we spoke about is, first, you've got to pull the appropriate line. Like they were saying earlier, you got people that all they want to do is pull an inch and three-quarter because it's easy. Well, in Fort Worth, we actually carry two-inch also, which is great. It gives you some of the maneuverability of inch and three-quarter. that gives you a whole lot more firepower. Now, you start pulling a 2.5 into a residential structure, you've got basically three guys on the line. They're going to have a real difficult time negotiating any types of turns. So once again, but you got to pull the appropriate line. We all carry thermal imagers. I think something like that. We're going to go in. I'm going to make a quick scan, see if we can find the seat of the fire. I agree with protecting the stairwell. That way you've protected the exit. And personally, what we've talked about, I've got my two regular firefighters. We've trained on this. I trust them. I'm going to leave them on the line. And, you know, whether it's perceived life hazard or an actual life hazard, I don't think you can really go by that. If it's perceived, to me it's real until you prove differently. And if you don't take every action you can to prove that differently, I think you're gapping yourself. So at that point, if we've got the stairs protected, then I'm going to break off. And we've all got radios. I'm going up and I'm going to start doing a search, knowing that there's that big of a gap. I can't wait. I can't wait around till fire's completely out or another company comes on. We've got, you know, this is kind of a catch-22. You either got your life safety that you've got to concern yourself with, but then you can't just go running through a house that's on fire. So you've got to try to, in this case, I think you've got to split your responsibilities. And if you've got people on the line that you trust, now if you've got a rookie or two rookies on that line, that changes it. But in a normal situation where you've got your two firefighters and you're training the way you should be, then I'm going to have faith in them that they're going to be able to control that fire. And if they're not, they're going to be able to radio me and let me know that the conditions are changing.
Okay. It's interesting with a thermal imaging camera. Does everybody on the show, do you have a thermal imaging camera on your apparatus, or who carries the thermal imaging cameras? We'll go back and start with Russ again. Who has a thermal imaging camera on your first alarm?
At the current time, the only ones that are carrying a thermal imager are the firefighters on the rescue company, and there's one Quint company in the city that's carrying a thermal imager, and all the three different battalion chiefs that we have assigned to the group, each one of them has a thermal imager as well.
Okay. Tom, how about you within FDNY, who's carrying a thermal imaging camera?
New York City policy, all truck companies have a thermal imaging camera, as do all the rescues and the squad companies.
Okay. Larry, in Fort Worth, what's the thermal imaging camera?
Every new engine or truck company that we get is supplied with a thermal imager. So on a normal residential structure fire, we get four engines in a truck, and so of those, and also a battalion chief. And so of those five apparatus, excluding the battalion chief, I would say four of the five is going to have a thermal imager on there.
Okay. Jeff, how about in Downers Grove?
Pete, we have a very specific operating guideline that we follow for the use of thermal imaging cameras. We're very fortunate in the regard that every suppression company is supplied with a thermal imager. In our policy, we have it stated that it is the company officer's responsibility to carry that tick on their person into any fire situation, regardless of the size of information that they're given. We train our people not to be overly dependent on the tick, though, in case there ever is a problem with it. So we do teach them and train them in the use of the tick, but we also make sure that we train them that it's not to be used as a replacement for sound search techniques.
Okay, and Ed, how about you guys out west?
In our organization, we have thermal imaging cameras or ticks assigned to every unit, and it's the officer's responsibility to utilize that tick on all incidents involving any type of report, investigation, reported smoke, or working incident.
Okay. I'm sorry about that. I was just that was another question I was going to bring up, but that was a kind of a decent time to bring it up in relation to this incident. And Jeff, we'll get back to you on the incident here where you have heavy smoke at 10:30 p.m. showing from a 2.5-story private dwelling with a car in the driveway. And as the officer, you take a look in the car and you see some child seats. So what are you looking at? What are you looking to go do at this point?
Well, you know, Pete, I know that this is a fictional situation that we have presented here, but it's unfortunate. This situation reeks of so many similarities that were faced by the brothers in Keokuk back in December of 1999. Some really tough decisions had to be made. Overall, though, I feel that no matter what situation that we get presented with, we have to maintain our strategic priorities. They can't change. And, of course, that's the safety and accountability of our people, then followed by the removal and rescue of occupants. But it's the tactics that we're going to put forth that are going to help us maintain those priorities. I know it was already mentioned about the size of information given with the smoke. We have that heavy brown smoke. Again, it was already mentioned that the fire is taking control of the structure. You have heavy brown smoke. Heavy smoke is telling me that we have a lot of smoke, high volume, which is going to in turn mean a lot of fire. We also have smoke that's pushing or under pressure. The fire is growing and it's looking for some ventilation. Without actual photos of the house that we're fighting this fire in and seeing the building, we don't know exactly how the home is put together. But most newer homes that we're seeing in our area are put together using lightweight building materials and trusses, especially the larger size homes. And if this fire is taking control of that structure, right, it's something that we have to really be concerned about. We may not have much time to operate in the situation that we have presented. But functioning as an engine company, I feel that we must attack and darken down a fire and get to the bedrooms of this home as quick as possible if that interior attack is able to be done. I know it's much easier said than done, but if we put the fire out, the problem does go away. We have to get that environment cooled down as fast as possible, stop that rapid fire spread that could be taking place with the smoke conditions. Once we get the fire darkened down on the lower level, hopefully we can proceed up the stairs to the bedrooms. And boy, by that time I would hope that second due company is there stretching a line to back up that stairwell for us and possibly give us some aggressive vent enter search from the exterior.
Okay. Ed, we'll finish up on this question with you. 10:30 at night, a heavy smoke from a two-story dwelling, car seats in the car, and there's nobody outside to greet you. What are you thinking? What are you going to do?
Well, like kind of everybody echoed, the one caveat to this is when assigned to the truck, I actually had this incident twice in my career. They were both daytime fires. And we operated tillered quints. And operating out of a light force house, the paramedic engine company was at the hospital both times. The truck company or Tillard Quint responded to a reported smoke in the area, same thing, and arrived on scene to find working residential structure fire with cars in the driveway both times. Again, the difference was the time of day. I'm going to kind of follow along line with everybody on the aggressiveness of going in on a perceived life safety situation. We get paid to do a job, and we're paid to do that job well. And one of our primary jobs is life safety. Arriving on scene as a company officer, first thing I would initiate would do make sure that my personnel are pulling the appropriate stretch. That's a 2,500 square foot house. It's a lot greater than a 150 foot pre-connect, so we're going to pull the adequate line down and have the line ready to be deployed. My job would be to do as much of a 360 as possible and identify where the greatest pressurization coming from the smallest orifice would be in the occupancy. That would give me a pretty good indication of where the highest degree of heat would be or the greatest turbulence of smoke, and help me in determining whether or not we have a first floor fire or a second floor fire. As everybody said, and I think it's worth repeating, thick brown pressurized smoke means that we have structural involvement. So as everybody said again, we're challenged with our time frame. Aggressive forcible entry is going to be accomplished. I want to have my personnel go in and search for the seat of the fire. I'll be passing off the thermal imaging camera to the backup fireman behind the nozzleman to assist in search, confinement, and extinguishment of that fire. And along those lines, I'll be following my command procedures, calling for resources, establishing a staging location, and then I'll be moving about being a working officer. It was mentioned previously in the show that one of the things that we can do is to force side and rear doors. One of our procedures is we call it force sweeps, force sweep and light, where you force the door, you check for conditions, you sweep the area around the door, and then you throw a box light down on the inside there to provide for means of firefighter access and egress. Being concerned of the potential of structural collapse, I'm going to be not only forcing those doors, but since it is a residential structure, I'm going to be taking the doors off, blowing them off the hinges and getting them out of the way in case we need to rapidly egress the structure or rapidly access the structure for our life safety or our firefighters. So, you know, to kind of wrap it up, our guys are going to go interior. They're going to utilize the tools that we have assigned to them, the thermal imaging camera. They're going to put a line between the fire and where it's going. If we can get confinement or possibly extinguishment, we're going to do that. We're going to search along the way. And based upon where the fire is located, I may even do what Larry said, which is if I got 7 minutes and my personnel are telling me that they've got a line between the fire and the upstairs, if it is a bottom floor fire, then I'll be going in on either a tag line or going in on an oriented search and searching the upstairs. That's pretty much what we'll do.
Okay. We'll be right back here on Radio at Firehouse. We're going to take another quick break, and we'll be back in just a second.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk here on Radio at Firehouse. We're going to finish up today's show with a second incident. Again, it's up to the five folks here to kind of give us their thoughts, their ideas and their tactics from their background in the fire service. And this incident is as follows. As the officer of a ladder company with a firefighter and driver, that's a total of three, you arrive to find heavy fire from the second floor of a two-story commercial building. The night watchman greets you with pleas to help locate two missing workers. The engine with you has a brand new lieutenant, and the chief's offers a 10-minute ETA over the radio. He's responding from a staff meeting at headquarters. Do you commit to the inside and pass the command, or do you set up a command post out front and send your one ladder company firefighter inside to assist the engine company? In this situation, it's personal discretion, I guess, would be the best bet as I'm looking at it. So, Larry, since this is a ladder company question and you're still assigned to an engine, we'll start with you on this one.
Okay, and I'll take it just from the engine company perspective. You know, the way I look at this, you say you've got a brand new lieutenant. You know, as far as the engine company goes, I'm sorry, that shouldn't matter. When you make lieutenant, you're at the very least expected to be able to take your crew in and start putting water on fire. That shouldn't make a difference. Now, I know from listening to Ed talk in the past, talking about you got guys with 2 and 3 years on the job that have they're now the rank of an officer. You know, I'm sorry, if you can't do the job, don't take the job. If you can't do the job and they find out you can't, get you out of the job. As far as if I were on the ladder company, you know, you've got a commercial building, two-story, you got people missing. At this point, you've got to get water on the fire. And I think at that point it's the most important. And a commercial building, you're going to have to go in with a 2.5, and there is just no way you can go in with an officer and one firefighter on a 2.5 and expect to even get that line close. So you're going to have more people on that fire. I guess in some more aggressive departments, they possibly could just send someone up to search. I don't think that's a good idea in a commercial building with heavy fire involvement that's two-story. Committing your people up on a second floor where there's known fire involvement. I know our job is to rescue people and to save people and to put our life into in harm's way, but it's foolish to send a couple guys up there for a search. All you're going to do is add to the either A, the body count, or B, the people that are missing. So I, think, yeah, the ladder company in this situation on a 3-man crew total, yeah, they're going to have to lend one of his guys to the engine company to start the fire attack. And at that point, now you're down to two people. You're going to have to just set up command outside and get everybody prepared and start giving assignments to incoming companies.
Okay. Next, we'll go with Jeff Pendelski.
In this situation, Pete, I feel like the ladder officer should remain outside to establish command, and I think he should give up his one-truck firefighter to assist with the engine company if an interior attack is even attainable at that point. The engine officer being new, I have to agree with what has been said already. That shouldn't make a difference. If he's not capable to handle that assignment, he technically should not have been put into that position already. However, if he is a weaker officer, the latter officer should still be able to keep a close tab on him by establishing a command post on the exterior, because he can focus on the overall incident as far as conditions and so forth go. To take command in a fast attack mode at this point may be detrimental with the conditions presented and also the resources that we have on scene. Size up again has to be real important in this situation. I mean, how certain are we that there are still two workers in that building? Were they working near the fire area? Where are they at? Are they even still viable? Again, it's mentioned we have the heavy fire showing in a commercial structure. We're going to have to upgrade that alarm as one of our biggest priorities. The building construction itself, occupancy, we have to take that into consideration. Again, with heavy amount of fire, do we have the ability at that time to meet the critical fire flow needed to even go interior on this? Commercial structure, heavy fire, it's already been mentioned that it's going to need at least a minimum of a 2.5 line let out into that building, if not even multiple. At this time, I'm not certain that we can accomplish that, and search should not take place unless we do have the hose lines in place. I feel our best bet or shot at maybe making a save of somebody that might be viable in this situation might be to put a quick hit on the fire with a master stream from the exterior, darken it down, quick hit, before we commit any firefighters to search efforts in the building. And once we commit those firefighters to the interior, they're going to they need to be searching under protection of a hose line. They're going to need the use of a thermal imaging camera, as well as large area search techniques. Again, as we all know, all these things that I've just mentioned, they're very labor-intensive. We really don't have the resources on scene at this time to effectively carry this out.
Okay. Tom Graber, you're up next.
All right. Pete, I was looking at this a little differently. I didn't know, you didn't state, or the question doesn't present how many firefighters the engine has. I was, the question about whether passing command and putting your one firefighter to assist the engine would be in contrast, or because if you're staying outside, then you wouldn't want to send one firefighter in alone to search. I was looking at it, are you going to go in with that firefighter? And I was taking it as the engine did have enough manpower to stretch the proper line. With that said, if the engine did have sufficient manpower to stretch a proper line into this building, I would look at it and try to get two main areas of concern would be if we could get more information from the watchman on where these two workers could or should be or where they were last seen, get a better fix on their position or where their possible position is, and then because it's a commercial structure, what type of roof system and what type of building construction are we talking about? Hopefully, if we're on top of our game and this is in our area, we're going to be familiar with the building and its building material due to our previous joints, whether it be from fire inspection, maybe we saw it when it was being built and we paid attention to it, maybe we have some type of program where we can put important information that comes up when this address comes in and we receive information on the building. But if we can find out where these workers are, then I would not pass the. I would go inside and try to see, at least do a search of whatever we could possibly accomplish to check that part off and try to address that life hazard. I wouldn't just wait outside and set up the command. Because there is a known life hazard in there, I would try to get in there with that firefighter, assuming that the engine has enough men to get a line in there to help us protect the fire or possibly contain it, and try to get a much of a search as we could possibly get due to the conditions, and try to see if we could address that life hazard.
Chief, this is Larry. I was assuming by the fact that there were three on the ladder company that there's also three on the engine.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And like I said, I know manpower issues and concerns vary greatly. Well, I guess the concerns are the same, but the manpower staffing varies greatly throughout the country. And I know this is something that you guys are typically presented with, where there is, at least in my opinion, I think everybody's, where there's not enough guys as we would prefer to have with us. But that was just the way I was looking at it, where he said, are you going to pass the question, do you commit to the inside and pass the command and set up a command post and send your one firefighter to the engine? So that was just the way I was looking at it. That's just the way I read it, okay?
All right, I do apologize for that. I should have stepped up with the staffing there. So, and with that said, it could be 2, 3, 4. I guess it's a little too late at this point, but... Ed, we'll come up to you next.
Okay. I'm going to kind of go back to my roots here and change it up a little bit. As a truck company officer with a crew of three, arriving on scene, we have heavy fire showing on the A and B sides of a two-story structure. My primary concern is changing the behavior of that building and making it more safe for the firefighters that are going to be going down below. So we would be passing command to the engine company officer and taking all three to the roof and start our ventilation operations. I'm going to make an assumption here that this is a two-story commercial occupancy center hallway type complex, where the greatest risk of hostile events or flashovers occurring is in that center hallway. So once we establish our offensive heat holes as close to, if not over, the fire as possible, we're going to be backing up and putting in those firefighter access holes. That will allow the engine company officer to make the determination based upon needed fire flow as to whether or not they're going to stretch 1 3/4 inches, which I would not recommend. A two-inch line that Larry has, which would be great with the smoothbore nozzle to get the penetration and reach and to start confining that fire. Or if need be, start the 2.5-inch stretch and utilize personnel that are coming in to assist in that stretch and back up and making an aggressive attack on that fire. Again, that would be the engine company officer's call. I agree with Larry and I agree with everybody else. Once you put on the bugles, you are one. And if you're not capable of making those strong decisions, then maybe you need to rethink the profession or at least the rank that you've chosen. And it's our job as chief officers to make sure we're putting the right people in the right job. But the ladder company officer needs to go to the roof with his two personnel. They need to start aggressive ventilation operations. They need to identify how much of the roof assembly is involved. They need to communicate that to the incident commander, which would be the lieutenant, establishing roof division, geographic location, and opening up this structure and changing the behavior of the building so that it makes it safer for our people below. On a final note, the last thing I would ever do as a ladder company officer would be to assign one of my guys to an engine company, especially if it was Larry, because I think my guy would come back with some personality issues that would take years to fix.
Larry, any rebuttal on that one?
I'll just defer to the chief.
Okay. Last up on this question is Russ Merrick.
First of all, what I'd like to know is find out what type of occupancy we're dealing with here. We're talking about a night watchman and some missing workers, so I'm not really sure what type of a occupancy we're going to be dealing with here. Heavy fire on the second floor is observed. Obviously, it's going to tell us a large diameter hose, so we're going to be looking at 2.5 I would put my firefighter with the guys on the engine to help stretch that line and do search on the line with them, and hopefully they'll teach the guys on the engine something instead of being corrupted. No. The other thing, like Tom was mentioning, I want to get some more information from that night watchman. Where were the workers' last known whereabouts? They might be remote from where the heavy volume of fire is, and we might be able to just start a search and rescue in that area there, and hopefully be successful in locating the two workers. If not, if they were last seen in the fire area, then obviously the stretching of the line and doing the search along the way would be the tactic I would want to do. I would also take command on this one, only because too often we've seen it in our district where you talk about this type of a structure, and it's easy to get lost or disoriented from inside. Visibility obviously is going to be less than desirable with the volume of fire we're talking about. So I would want to have a command outside so I could be continually watching the progress of the fire. It might be at such a point that we may have to withdraw because we just don't have the resources there. In addition to that, then I would also, right from the get-go, this thing's got second alarm written all over it for our jurisdiction. So that would have already been requested, additional resources. I would want to be putting my incident action plan together and putting my strategy together so that those additional alarms that are coming, I would have tasks for them when they got there so we could assign them tasks. So I think it's important that on this commercial style building, someone has to take command and establish a command so that these other units that are coming in are given tasks that need to be addressed and performed.
Okay, Larry, you had brought up the fact that as an officer, you should have the knowledge and the know-how of what to do in a situation. And Tom, you had brought up earlier, in the Bronx, it's a little bit different from where you are because you can have different companies coming from different locations, and you may not know every officer and everybody on the crew just because of the size of your job. Whereas those in a smaller department would have a good idea. But Tom, what do you, everybody on the crew is going to be a little bit different in their strengths and weaknesses. Where do you, could you do like a crew size up?
Well, in the city, we have an expected competency level of all the members. And I think as compared to out where I live in the volunteer department, where I'm also a volunteer, When you have these situations, would, like I mentioned earlier, they could be very well fit into a situation in the volunteer departments where you only have one or two guys responding, other units or other resources taking a long time to get there. You could be presented with these situations. And I brought up about sizing up and how it continues to size up. I think unlike in the city where I work, when you're a volunteer, if you're a volunteer officer or a volunteer chief, a very important part of your size up would have to be you have to size up the manpower that you have with you responding. It's just a reality that just because you have three men on the back step doesn't mean that you can expect each of them to do the same job the same way, where we have stronger guidelines and stronger requirements for the paid departments. So what I mean is you're going to have to size up the manpower that you have with you. Not just do I have three guys, but what can I realistically expect this guy to accomplish and that person to accomplish and that firefighter to accomplish. In the real world, some guys are just not comfortable or maybe even just not physically able to do a certain task, whether it's a portable ladder or doing a search on the second floor off a portable ladder or manning a 2.5-inch hose. Some might be more comfortable and just need to be and very proficient at advancing a hose inside a structure, where some, because of maybe their training or skill level, have just not mastered that or not comfortable enough doing an aggressive interior attack. So I think it's a very important part for, like I mentioned, a volunteer chief or a volunteer officer, that when you size up the fire, you're also sizing up what resources you have and how you can best use the resources that you have with you, as far as what task and what you expect from them.
Pete, can I chime in real quick?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree that size up is so vitally important, and I just want to add that this is a ladder company type question. Is it particularly on the West Coast, given the amount of lightweight engineered structures that we deal with, and the roof assembly collapse that collapses down upon and entraps so many of our firefighters, that size up truly include a roof division size up, so that once the personnel are on the roof, at whatever point in time the incident commander assigns the roof division, and they establish what type of roof assembly they're dealing with, and they have some type of visual indication, whether it be through inspection holes, smoke indicator holes, or fire venting through the roof, where the fire is located, the amount of roof assembly involvement, and any type of hazards that are on top of that roof, they need to communicate that to the interior crews. Because as we've seen throughout history, we've had roof assembly collapse on personnel that were deep into the structure fighting the fire, and little did they know that they had, you know, fire rolling above their head or behind them because of the drop ceilings and the void spaces, and the particularly out here in the West Coast, the truss roof construction with the HVAC and heavy machinery on the roof, which adds an enormous load to the roof assembly. So along with what the chief was saying, I think it's very important for our officers to realize that size up includes a roof division size up.
Hey, Pete, this is Larry. I think what you
Larry.
One part of your original question here was about the companies that are responding with you, and I agree, you have to know their strengths and weaknesses. I'm fortunate that I work in a very busy part of town, and the companies that I respond with, I know for a fact, just from responding with them so much, that they are as good as it gets. But there is definitely a difference in crews. We can respond with one of several different truck companies, and one truck company, you know, we've nicknamed them the Super Friends. You know, they can pretty much do anything. Other truck companies, although good, not quite Super Friends. So I think that's an important part of any incident you go to, with how you approach a situation, knowing who's coming to help you. And I know that's different in a volunteer situation where you may get companies from different cities that you've never met these guys, but hopefully, knowing that situation could come up, you've at least done some type of training with them so that you've got something to base that decisions on.
Hey,
yes,
Pete, one more thing.
Pete,
I'd like to throw this out to the rest of the guys. Do you feel as a group that as an organization having strong standard operating guidelines would assist in this scenario?
I think that helps with any situation.
Anybody else?
Here's another thought for you, too, Pete. This is Russ. I know sometimes we have a strong mutual aid agreement in the department where I'm from. We work regularly with county companies and city units all the time. And some of the county companies are combination departments, and some of them are strictly volunteer. So much like Tom said, for a good size up of personnel that are coming in, we may not be familiar with them, and it's important that we train with them as often as we can. I know we don't train with them as much as we'd like to, but we work a four-group system, so there's, you know, at any given time, one group may have trained with that company, and the other three may never have trained with them. So again, knowing the people that are going to be on the fire ground, knowing their capabilities, their strengths, their weaknesses, is important, because we're only going to be as good as our weakest link in that case there. So there's the possibility that we may not even know the personnel coming on some of the apparatus if we call for mutual aid. It depends on the time of day. It depends on who's available and who gets on their fire trucks to respond. So that can be an important factor.
Okay, anybody want to follow up with Ed and the importance of the standard operating procedures or guidelines, depending on your department's wording?
I'll make a comment too on, while I'm there, I'll make a comment on the standard operating guidelines. They're absolutely important in anything that we do, and it's just like I said, it's a guideline. It's given us guidance and direction to do something instead of doing nothing. It's given us some options there that we can look at and call upon. Granted, there's a lot of new firefighters and officers coming up through the ranks that they may not have seen as much as myself or some of the other gentlemen here today on the show. And for them to pull up on a situation and have never been confronted with it before, they're going to have to call on those guidelines to help them get going in the right direction.
Hey, Pete, this is Tom.
Yes.
Graber. Ed was talking about the guidelines, I agree they're extremely important for us to have and for all companies and all units, departments to have. But besides that, just like this little roundtable discussion on an incident, whether it's an incident that happened or the one that you're delivering to us here, it's very important, and this is why shows like this are so good, because it stimulates the thought process into what if. And you know, guidelines are absolutely good. They do present us with a guideline to do, but there are variables. When you have shows like this, and for your listeners out there that are thinking of these questions and thinking, hey, this could be me tonight, this could be me next month, and you're stimulating the thought process of what I would do. And the best part about shows like this, you're hearing different perspectives of it. You're hearing different ideas of something that you say, hey, well, that's a real good point. I didn't even think of something like that, or I didn't even think of that angle. And you're getting such a diversified look where people, hopefully, by listening to these programs, they're sharpening and honing their skills. And if they ever are confronted with a situation that's like this or similar, they'll be better armed to make the right decision or the best decision at that time.
Okay, Tom.
Pete, Russ here. Can I just add one other thing?
Go ahead, Russ.
I think it's not a standard operating guide or a procedure that we have per se, but a tool that we've developed in our department is what we call a multiple alarm report. And anytime our city has a fire that is of a second alarm or greater, we prepare a scenario of it. There's a report that comes out on it. The companies that responded to the incident, what their role and function was there, what their discharge lines were, what their supply lines were, the times that the alarm came in, the times the extra units were dispatched. There's a place for additional comments on there for what did we have when we got there, what did we do that worked well, what did we do that maybe didn't work so well, what were some unusual circumstances that occurred at that event that maybe we haven't seen in a while or maybe we've never seen at all. We put that in the comments section, and then at the bottom of the report, there's an area there for a diagram, and we put a diagram down there of where the units were, where the lines were stretched, ladders, and whatnot. So then all this information we have after a major fire like that, we have the company officers go back to their quarters with their crews and sit down and fill out a critique form. This asks pointed questions as to what they saw, what they did, where they responded from, where their delays, and some other stuff. Those forms are then passed up through the battalion chief, and the battalion chiefs and the deputy chiefs, along with the safety officer, when those reports all come in, they'll sit down, they go over those reports to come up with their final critique on the fire, then they'll critique with the first in units at that fire, but they'll take everything that came off of those forms to put this second alarm report together on. Then that report is copied and sent out to all the divisions and companies to throughout our city, so that you may not have been working that shift, you may not have gotten that job that shift, but at a future point in time within a week or two, there's a report that comes out about that incident, and you can sit down and you can read about it, you can look at it with the other firefighters there, some of the things that happened at that incident, so that education and learning has taken place even if you weren't at that scene. So it's been a great tool for us.
It's a great idea.
Hey, Pete,
a true critique and after action report, which should really be done after every incident, you know.
Yeah, unfortunately
it's
not.
Everybody involved. So anybody else have any last minute ideas, comments, questions?
Pete, this is Larry.
Go ahead,
talking about the standard operating guidelines or procedures. Those are crucial, very critical on any department, but they're only a starting spot. I mean, that's where everybody starts from, and then you start working from there. And from that, you've got to start drawing from your experiences and or your training. And I think way too many departments fall into the trap of thinking, we know what we're doing, our way is the right way, and our way is the only way. And they never want to look at another way of doing it. You know, down here in Fort Worth, you know, we can look up at the guys at New York City and go, you know, yeah, those guys are great, but everything they've got is, you know, 90 stories in the air. And the biggest building we have here in Texas, or here in Fort Worth, is, you know, not quite 40 stories, you know, but that's a mistake, because we can still take what they do up in New York and learn from them and make what we do down here at our high rises better. And I think just too many departments, too many firefighters think that, like I said, their way is the only way, and they don't want to look at, you know, well, I work on the East Coast, what can somebody from the West Coast teach me?
Well, you know, along those lines, Larry, I think that was what was so helpful out here on the West Coast, is we started doing a lot of that East Coast, East meets West training type scenarios, and having Firehouse out here in San Diego was definitely a huge benefit to increasing the knowledge and the experience of our firefighters out here, having people like yourself and Mike Dugan and John Salka and Butchie Cobb and those guys come out here and share their experiences. And I really think it's important for the leaders of today's fire service to make sure that our younger members are participating in these types of conferences and these types of training environments and listening to these types of programs, so that they do get a different perspective, because what you said is that whole groupthink thing that goes on, and there are different ways of doing it, and there's a lot better ways of doing it. So I agree with you.
Hey, Pete.
Yes.
Jeff here. Just wanted to chime in on everyone else's comments here. Boy, attitude is truly the crane that colors our world, and it does have a great effect on firefighter safety on the fire ground. That's for certain. Again, the SOGs are very, very critical and important, as already said. But I think it's also important that we have to give our company officers still the ability to make a decision based on their experience, like the other guys mentioned also. We have to approach everything with an open mind. As said already, you know, the attitude about, you know, this is the only way to do something. You got to have that open mind. You have to find what works for your department or your crew, and you have to take the proper channels to adapt it to work for your department. Again, there's more than one way to skin a cat. You know, if plan A doesn't work, it's always nice to have a B and a C.
Okay.
Hey, Jeff, Russ, just on that same note, I agree 100% there. We've got to allow our officers to make decisions. Whether they're right or wrong, they've got to be encouraged. Even when they're wrong, they got to be encouraged that at least they made the decision. They know that they made a mistake that time, and hopefully they learn from that mistake. It's a learning experience, and all too often I've seen situations where an officer will make the wrong decision or make a decision that probably wasn't the best one out of the lot that he had to pick from, and get himself chastised right there on the spot in front of his crew and in front of the rest of his peers and subordinates, and it's like, that shouldn't happen.
Absolutely.
We need to encourage him, I agree. The guidelines are guidelines, but, you know, we got to leave room for interpretation so that our officers are able to make decisions and not fear that if they make a decision, they're going to get their legs cut out from underneath them, because that's only going to stifle them, and then they're not going to make decisions.
Hey guys, Tom Graber, I just agree wholeheartedly with, you know, Ed and Larry and you guys are saying, you never stop learning. And if you think you're only going to learn from a certain company or a certain department because they're bigger or they're this or they're that, that's just a total misnomer. You can learn from anybody and any company and any department, because great ideas and great practices come from all over the place.
Okay, and with that said, I guess we'll wrap up this first show of Training and Tactics Talk. It's going to be a monthly podcast, so please tune in each month and do listen. Our goal here is to bring in a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of tactics, and a little bit of the training from the East Coast to the West Coast and everywhere in between. So today I would like to thank Jeff Pendelski from Downers Grove, Illinois, Russ Mayer from Rochester, New York, Larry Manasco from Fort Worth, Texas, Ed Hadfield from Paso Robles, California, and Tom Graber from FDNY. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please drop us an email at podcasts@firehouse.com, and we look forward to doing another show in just a few weeks here. Thank you very much, and have a good day.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.